Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. This is Dr. Om, clinical sexologist with Xander Keg, licensed social worker. This hour, we have experts who are serving as panelists, and Xander will introduce our guests.
Absolutely, On. We have a great show up today. It's a special show. We have three guests who have all been on the show before and all who work in the trans health and trans advocacy space. So our first guest is Dr. Erica Anderson. She's an accomplished clinical psychologist, academic administrator, healthcare executive, a professor, and a consultant. During a career that spans four decades, she has held academic appointments in health psychology, public health, clinical psychology, healthcare management, and pediatrics. Our second guest is Dr. Jamison Green. Dr. Green is a pioneering advocate for transgender health, rights, and social safety. He led FTM International from 1991 to 1999 and has served on the boards of many organizations, including the Transgender Law and Policy Institute and the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. He's the author of the prize-winning memoir, Becoming a Visible Man, which is now available in print, ebook, and audiobook formats. And our final guest is Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper. She is a professor emerita in the School of Graduate Psychology at the Pacific University in Oregon. She currently engages in full-time clinical work in her private practice. Previously, she worked at Seattle Children's Hospital and Boston Children's Hospital, where she was the founding psychologist for the Gender Management Services, or GEMS, clinic, where she developed the psychological assessment protocol for transgender adolescents seeking medical interventions. Welcome, James and Erica and Laura, to the show. Welcome back.
It's great to be back.
I don't always get asked back, so this is a real pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we are so happy to have you back. You're all coming from this space of trans health, trans advocacy in different contexts. And I'd say that one of the issues that I hear coming up a lot lately is this concept of gender dysphoria, right? I'm a trans man, On's a trans man. So most of us in the show today are trans. We have a personal stake in it, but we're also professional. So let's talk about gender dysphoria. What I'd like for each of you to do is just give your description of what gender dysphoria is and maybe what it's not. Erica, if you'd like to start, what is your description for gender dysphoria? How do you talk to people about gender dysphoria?
Gender dysphoria is the current diagnosis that appears in DSM-5 that usually is an entry point for people who want to get healthcare services to support a trans identity. I think of gender dysphoria as distress about an incongruence between how a person feels about their gender and how they were registered or assigned at birth, what gender they were given, what sex they were given. So I think of it as distress. And this helps me distinguish between many people who question their gender, especially young people, or are thinking about their gender, but they're not particularly distressed. So to me, gender dysphoria does require distress. Not that I want people to have distress. I don't. But that's the hallmark for me of gender dysphoria.
Thank you so much. James, when somebody says to you, what's gender dysphoria? How do you respond to that?
Well, I think it's an incongruence between your sense of self and how people are expecting you to be that revolves around your gender and your sex assignment. So there's a lot of ways you can be in conflict with society about how people expect you to behave and you're not doing it. I'm not a clinician, so I'm not going to rely on DSM-5 or DSM-4 or DSM-3, or which was in force when I transitioned. It was DSM-3, so it was then called transsexualism. I was not unhappy with my body per se, and I was accustomed to being in conflict with people's behavioral expectations because I had too much energy. I was disruptive. I'm talking about being in junior high school, for example. I got moved from every girls' PE class. I wasn't like a mean person or anything, but so they thought that other people were influencing me, and they thought if they moved me to different cohorts, I would learn how to behave. But that was never the case because I couldn't be a girl in a PE class with girls. I knew I belonged in the boys' PE class, and I had too much energy, and people didn't know what to do with me. People mistook me for a boy when I was wearing dresses, and yet I knew I was okay. I knew I was a good person. So I didn't think, oh, well, I should be a boy. That was completely out of the realm of possibility. Never seen anybody who had transitioned from female to male. So to me, gender dysphoria is the realization that you can't survive in this society in the body that people have told you have to be in. And I compare it to a woman I know who had breast cancer and had to have her breast removed. And she hated doctors and surgeries and all that kind of stuff. And so she didn't want to have reconstruction. But about 2 years after the removal, she realized that it was impossible for her to go on existing with her body not representing who she was. For her, that meant having breasts. And so she did have reconstruction. And she was seeing a psychiatrist because she had a terminal cancer diagnosis and she was trying to raise two young children. So she needed some mental health assistance. And her psychiatrist said, you have gender dysphoria. It's really very closely tied with what your body represents and how you are treated and how you function in society. It's not just about being a rebel. It's not just about fantasy.
Laura, how about you? Let's say you're giving a presentation and somebody asked this question about gender dysphoria. Can you explain that to me? What do you say?
I'm going to take this question in a slightly different direction because I don't have a whole lot to add beyond what has already been said. As a cisgender person, so I haven't had the kind of experience others here have had in terms of the degree of feeling the disconnect with my body or my assigned gender. What I've come to realize over the years of doing this work is that it seems that many of the people who come to me from clinical services do experience a degree of gender dysphoria. But the bigger question in my mind is, what complicating factors are there that may have led to that for that individual person? And how severe is it? How long has it been a problem for them? And particularly when we're talking about young people, I can say for myself, even as a cisgender person, at times through my life, especially during early puberty, I experienced a degree of gender dysphoria. I found one of my early journals from that time period and wrote about how much I wish I could be a boy because of what was expected as a girl at that time and my body changing in ways I felt very uncomfortable with. But it never reached a level where I felt like I was in the wrong body or had been assigned the wrong gender. But some of the youth who I work with have had traumatic experiences or have really very serious mental health issues that have caused them to feel uncomfortable in general about themselves and then start to wonder about their gender. And that does appear like gender dysphoria, like we're talking about. But I think if we just only ask the questions in the DSM or look at what we're talking about here in terms of the way that can manifest, we're not really getting the whole picture for the individual child, which I think is really critical when trying to develop a treatment plan and think about what services are going to be best or interventions are going to be best for that individual.
Erica, you kicked it off by talking about distress and incongruence. And Jameson, you also mentioned those things. What I was hearing, there can be a type of incongruence that can be mental, physical, behavioral, and social. Mm-hmm. And then the distress level that comes with that might have something to do with whether a person has an internal or external locus of control, how much pressure there is to conform within their family, within their school, within their faith community, the different levels, talking about the severity. Jameson, you talked about DSM-3, transsexualism. I transitioned under DSM-4, which was gender identity disorder. Now we're DSM-5, TR, which is gender dysphoria. The ICD is now gender incongruent. So there's all these different terms that have been used, diagnoses that have been used. And I wonder if that might confuse people, especially if you think about the mental, physical, behavioral, and social aspects of this. I remember under gender identity disorder, there was mild, moderate, severe. I don't know if gender dysphoria has that. And also there was one where if you were post-transition, it was almost like you were in remission of gender identity disorder. I wonder if you think there's some contributing factor in maybe people's misunderstanding or confusion or frustration from outside looking in, that there has been these changes in diagnostic terms, and that trans people, you bring us together and we all tell a very different story that has some semblance of sameness. but we're not all having the same experience and choosing the same journeys to go on. And I think people really would like it if we were all cookie cutters of each other. That'd make things easier, but we're not. And so I'm just wondering if you think some of these factors might be complicating the issues that are going on, especially now with these people proposing laws and policy changes.
Laura and I talk pretty regularly and sometimes about cases. And I think we both see a lot of young people who tell us that they have gender dysphoria. And in my case, I always want to ask, what does that mean for a young person, teenager even? It isn't always the same answer that comes back. And as you point out, Xander, when people get to thinking about whatever gender dysphoria is, they focus on sometimes on different aspects. So when I interview about gender dysphoria, I'm often trying to inquire about the internal felt idea of gender that the person has in their mind, any distress that they might have about their body and whether their thoughts about it are that it doesn't match what they would like. And then lastly, an issue that Jameson brought up, which is, how do people treat me? Am I treated the way I want? And the language these days is, am I gendered correctly? Do people use my preferred name and pronouns? And then there's huge individual differences in terms of how at least young people respond to each of those different aspects. So I think it can be different. I try to, it's kind of hard to do it, but I try to quantify the level of distress in each of the three areas that I am asking about. There's no uniformity. Some kids are really distressed about their bodies, some not so much so. Some are really distressed about social interactions and how the world treats them, and some don't say much about that. And some are very certain about their identity internally, and they're not swayed by any external information. They just say, this is who I am. In fact, I often have kids say, well, I can't really put it in words, but I'm really sure about it. You know, this is how I feel.
And I appreciate what you just said, Erica, that there's so much diversity in experience. In this realm, a lot depends on your language skills, and a lot depends on your ability to be introspective. The people who came up with all these definitions, for the most part, are not trans people. They don't have the experience that trans people have. So they're trying, and this is why it changes so much, they're trying to figure out how to describe what we experience, that they don't know what that is. At the same time, if you look at the rapid vocabulary changes within the transgender community itself, we are all trying desperately to figure out the language to describe who we are and what we experience. And that, for people on the outside, may be extremely confusing. I know I'm pretty clear about what I think, what I feel. I'm 75 years old at this point, and I'd better be pretty clear about it. At age 39, when I began my transition, I was pretty clear too. And yet I also knew at that time, I did not have the language as a writer to explain exactly what was happening and exactly what I needed. And so I have spent most of my adult life since then contemplating this and trying to figure out how to explain this. It is quite complex. And that's because our entire history of understanding what sex is, what the two sexes are, and what society expects from us as human beings throughout history for millennia, that's been what we have struggled with. That is our core struggle. So it's not surprising to me that people are confused. It's also not surprising to me that people manage to live their lives without having the major conflicts as trans people, without running into all the horrible things that are happening to so many people these days, and particularly young people who are being attacked and beat up and having so many horrible things happen to them. There's a way of being in the world where you are okay with people being different from you. And what we've got right now going on in many political contexts is people are not okay with people being different from them. And that's where it breaks down. People are always going to be different from you. No one is just exactly like everyone else. And I don't know why we've lost touch with that. But to give people the space to be themselves doesn't take a lot of effort.
But it does take some.
It does take some, but it doesn't take a lot if you really think about it and think about the value that you are trying to accomplish for being supportive of other people. It does take some. You have to be conscious.
We don't only have to look outside of the trans community for how this not okay with difference, because
that's
it's
right.
Also within our community that we're struggling to accept the differences that are just naturally occurring because we're individuals. It's like the outside world is shining that light on us. We're shining it in ourselves. We're shining it back out. I think it does complicate things when we're not unified in a message, which again, doesn't necessarily have to happen, but I think we get comfortable with that. It really was helpful when Martin Luther King Jr. came out ahead as a civil rights leader. Of course, there were other people leading other Black Power movement and Nation of Islam movement and around the same time, but people did look to MLK in that branch, so to speak, of the civil rights movement, and it helped move it along. I think the same thing can be said about when the gay rights movement really grabbed a hold of things like, we need to get married, we need to be able to adopt children, we need to be able to protect it in our jobs, in our housing, in our employment, and also we need to be able to serve in the military. They took it away from queer rights activists and said, we need these things. We need to be equal citizens in our country. I'm not sure what's going to happen in the trans community to move things forward.
I have long said, if you take away a person's health care, you're taking away their humanity. And that's what's happening to trans people right now.
One of the problems that I've seen in the last 15 or so years I've been doing this work is I felt like we were very much moving in a positive direction for a while. And the recognition of differences among humans related to gender was growing. The media acknowledgement and representation of trans people, I think, really helped. What I feel is really causing us to take several steps back, honestly, is the train wreck that is occurring within the pediatric trans field. I think that there are so many problems right now that are occurring within the pediatric field that it's just causing more tension among everyone. And it's becoming more political, but I think it's going both ways. That's driving the politics. The politics are driving the tension and the polarization within the field. And it's then now trickling over to adult care. And I have serious concerns about this. And I think that until we make some improvement to what's happening with young people, because they're a vulnerable population. People on both sides of the political spectrum care about children. And so if people feel that children are being harmed in any kind of way, emotions go wild. And so I think somehow we have to get a handle on that for things to improve, generally speaking, for the whole trans community.
Can you just nutshell what this pediatric issue is?
I mean, it's such a big question and a hard question to put in a nutshell, but I'll say a few things and I'm sure Erica can chime in too. It's trickling out into a lot of realms, but in terms of the medical realm, what I would say is that there are very different opinions about how to approach the care ethically and responsibly, with one extreme feeling that we should not be treating minors medically at all. The other extreme feeling that we should treat any minor who walks through the door and says they're gender dysphoric and they identify as trans and they want medical interventions without any questioning whatsoever. The word exploration has become taboo among that group of medical providers. So we have these two extremes, and the WPATH Standards of Care version 8, I feel, did a fairly good job at addressing some of those issues and tried to make it more clear, like what should happen in these assessments and when working with minors. But there's still a lot of room for interpretation from one provider to the next. And so I think that there's just so much disagreement among how to best treat young people struggling in this way.
You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Kagg. Our panelists are Drs. Erica Anderson, Jameson Green, and Laura Edwards-Leeper. We hope that you have enjoyed the discussion so far. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Delightful news, air travelers. Going in and out of airports without getting sick can be challenging. Time to take charge of the air you breathe with Nasal Guard. Nasal Guard topical gel defends by blocking harmful airborne particles, and viruses. Try NasalGuard for air travelers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about NasalGuard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle Magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle Magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Kagg. Our panelists this hour are doctors Erica Anderson, Jameson Green, and Laura Edwards Leeper. They have been talking about trans identities and what that means, and also the differences in opinion in the medical world on whether or not to treat the pediatric population who identify as trans. Let's pick up where we left off.
That at least is one part of the problem, as I see it, is that we don't have an agreement in the field on the best approach. What assessment really means? Is assessment even necessary? Should parents be involved? Should they not? And trying to take a more nuanced, individualized approach seems to be very difficult, in part because of the rapidly growing numbers of young people seeking treatment. Clinics can't keep up. So there's a host of problems. And I'm only touching on the medical side of it. We could talk also about what's happening in the schools and extremes in that realm as well. But I think that there's a lot happening that's making the patient population very complicated and more difficult to tease apart all the different factors. And then the disagreements, like in terms of the philosophical approach among providers, is another big problem.
So you'd say it's not accurate that as Admiral Rachel Levine in the U.S. here in our Health and Human Services Department said, there's a consensus on these matters. Speaking as a pediatrician, this disagreement is pretty broad because we've got several nations that have decided to do different things than what we're doing here in the U.S. and what they're doing in Canada. And I'm wondering if you can maybe speak a little bit to those differences.
As Laura says, the disagreements are kind of extreme. I do think that for the most part, people who are joined in these conversations are concerned about children and the safeguarding of children. On the one hand, I would say the progressive left side of the equation, people are concerned that about something Jameson introduced, which is concerned that trans kids won't get the care that they need. They won't get the support that they need, and that something they're very alarmed about. And these laws passed in various states, I think, just fuel the fire in terms of being afraid that healthcare is going to be taken away, options are going to be taken away. I should hasten to add, Laura and I think, speak as one that we are opposed to the bills that ban this care. That's not something that we're wanting at all. On the far right, the people who get all energized and want to ban this care think that in effect, I'm going to be a little inflammatory, but they think that giving gender-affirming care to any minor is a medical scandal. And the language used is really horrible. We have people on the left crying out, saying you're going to kill trans kids if you create any limits or channel care in any way other than complete open access. And people on the right say you're harming kids by providing the care. And that's a huge gulf difference in point of view. And I think fundamentally it's a false binary, because I think most well-meaning people do care about children and they want to do right by children. So the devil's in the details, as they say. You can't bridge that kind of gulf by just using a bullhorn and trying to talk down the other side. We have to have more conversation. We have to talk about nuance. For example, one of the things that has been true in the United States, at least, is a lot of clinicians working with gender questioning kids try to justify the decision to introduce hormones by saying, well, you can have a live son or a dead daughter, invoking what they believe sincerely is the data about the suicidal risk of gender questioning kids. We just had a study published now. Laura and I heard about it months ago in Finland, where they did a comprehensive study of all the kids treated in gender clinics over a 12-year period. And the risk of suicide did not go down for those kids who were treated by the gender clinics, which challenges the assumption that gender-affirming care in the form of medicines will be life-saving and will reduce the risk for kids. And of course, there's some technical things there. They did compare the kids in the clinics with controls, and they did point out that the kids who were treated in the clinics did have a number of them had significant co-occurring psychiatric issues. But when you compare the kids who had psychiatric issues who were treated in the gender clinics and the kids who had psychiatric issues but not gender dysphoria, the rates of suicidality and completed suicides were roughly equivalent. So that's an example of, that's a real nuanced discussion shortly about suicide, but a lot of people get alarmed by some of the things that they think are going on or they worry are going to go on or whatever, and we need more light, less heat.
So what are the harms? Are we studying that? Because everything that I've read varies.
Are you asking about the harms done to kids who have gender-affirming care, including medicines?
Yes.
We don't have a complete answer. Laura is probably better positioned to answer this, but we need more research. Some of the studies, the big studies that have come out, including the multi-site study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, refrained from telling us about all the data that they collected, and they didn't even report on, did gender dysphoria change? Did it decrease in the kids who were followed in these clinics? So I think there's a lot of confusion about this, and we just don't have a lot of answers. The CAS Commission in the UK has been doing evidence reviews of a lot of these areas, social transition, puberty blockers, cross-sex hormone surgeries for young people. And like the other European authorities, they've come out in their final reports coming out in weeks that the evidence supporting the medical interventions is weak. It's not as strong as we always thought. And part of that may be, my opinion, that we've conflated the population of kids who are going forward in gender clinics, and we've commingled a very heterogeneous group, unlike the other studies historically from the Netherlands and elsewhere, Sweden, where the treatment seemed to be beneficial for a carefully screened group of young people.
I would also just add that in addition to more research and systematic reviews of the current research on the potential medical harms of puberty blockers or hormones when given to youth, the other research that is starting to grow, fortunately, is on detransitioners. And I would say, from talking with researchers who do that work, and I agree with this, the concern is not so much about people who detransition and are comfortable with their decision to detransition, or maybe they detransition from being a trans-binary man to a non-binary individual or something like that. But it's more a concern about people who detransition and have significant regret about their initial transition and feel that maybe the process was rushed or the underlying mental health issues that they had weren't dealt with sufficiently. and then later realized that that was really maybe what was driving their dysphoria. And they weren't a good candidate ultimately to transition medically. So when working with youth, that's really what I am trying to help prevent as part of the assessment process is detransition later with regret. And sometimes with the regret comes a host of serious mental health problems, sometimes worse than what the young person had before they transitioned the first time. So I think that's the research that I'm very grateful that people are starting to do, and it's being published. And I think it should really guide our clinical work.
Yeah, because we don't have those numbers yet. We don't really know what comprises that population, right?
Yes, and the only way to get those numbers is to continue studying the population rather than saying they don't exist or cutting off any kind of research support.
You're going to be involved in discussions in different venues with different people than Laura and Erica are. And I'm wondering, what kinds of discussions are you hearing within the trans community, especially people that are involved in trans healthcare and that are part of the trans community, because there's so many of us now? What are you hearing people saying about these medical review boards and the reports that are coming out of these European and Scandinavian countries, these liberal countries that were the trailblazers for this gender-affirming care, who are now starting to pump the brakes a bit and say, we need to slow down, we need to change, we need to do research, we need to collect data? How do you think people are responding to that news?
People, for the most part, think that this is reactionary because they don't have a lot of information. Not everybody is a clinician. Not everybody knows how to read a technical medical article. The danger of overgeneralization about left and right, for example, there are people who have been lifelong conservatives whose children have transitioned successfully, and they completely understand the value of that process for their child. And they are still conservatives. They are Republican voters. They are out there. You can't overgeneralize these things. And I think what's happening is lay people read about these studies, because they're not reading the studies themselves. They assume the same kind of thing that's going on here, that there's a reaction, that it's a reactionary opposition, because that's the way we are as human beings conditioned to think, that there's black and there's white, there's good and there's evil, there's people who care and people who don't. The world is not that binary. I think it makes sense to be cautious. I think it makes sense to question. And I think it makes sense to provide individualized care, because there certainly are going to be young people who do know themselves well, who will benefit from transition. Analysis of the data from the 2022 survey of over 90,000 trans people have just been released. And 94% of trans people who have been through transition feel positive about what has happened in their lives since then, feel that that was of great benefit to them. And there aren't a lot of young people involved in this survey. I think there was a restriction. They didn't want people under 18 taking the survey, I think. These are adults that are speaking. And probably some of those adults had miserable childhoods. Not all, but some. And yet they've survived and they've thrived, and they credit their transition as part of that. And I think as scientists and clinicians look more at the actual lives of people and not at just cohorts, and look at the language that's used and look at the actual treatments that are provided and analyze this, we will learn. Clearly, there's something going on in human beings that makes this happen. And if we ignore it and pretend that it doesn't exist, we will never find out what's going to actually benefit people.
I appreciate you bringing up the it's not so easy as left and right. You gave the example of the conservative parents with a trans child. On the other side, I've met several lesbian moms with gender nonconforming kids who are absolutely not supportive of their kids doing a medical gender transition. It's not so simple as saying liberal good, conservative bad, or liberal pro. Well,
sexual orientation is not necessarily an indicator of your political positions.
That's right. There's most likely, let's be fair, there are good faith and bad faith actors in some of this. I think there are people who think they're doing the right thing. They don't know the actual full as we can know science around these things. And they want to be kind and compassionate and loving and non-judgmental. And then I think there are people who on both sides that want to keep everything going, of people who want to pump the brakes. And then I think there are people also on, quote, both sides. They know that it's not right to take away agency and medical decision-making from adults. They know that these European countries are making sound decisions, that it's not influenced by their, by the way, very liberal members of government in these countries. These are not conservative countries, right? This isn't a conservative governments in Sweden and Finland that are influencing these decisions. But I think nonetheless, they just say, I don't care. I don't care what they're doing. They're wrong. And I'm going to fight it. This is another area where I think there's complication. How do we and how do others figure out the difference between the good faith actors and the bad faith actors? Because who are people mostly going to see? It's going to be on social media. And I think that's where the bad faith actors are.
It's complicated.
I know I've been, Erica has been, Laura has been, Jameson, I think you've also have been on, I don't know if you've been on the receiving end of people who have gotten very angry at positions we've taken, statements we've made, individuals we've supported or remained friends with who are the wrong kind of people. There's a cost to being principled and allowing for nuance and complexity.
And there's also the words conservative and liberal mean different things in different countries, too. Generally, people just react out of their own self-interest and things that they know. And not everybody knows everything about everybody. To not put a conservative or liberal label on anything, there are people who are capable of reaching out, standing something that's different than they have experienced in the past, of having that kind of openness to seeing another person who is different from them and recognizing their intrinsic worth, and they might experience things differently. And there are people who just can't. And I think that's where we are.
I also wanted to point out that we have individuals such as Dr. Erica Anderson, who is obviously qualified to report concerns, not saying you aren't, James, but from a clinical perspective, right, who sees children and hears from children. Same with Dr. Laura Edwards Sleeper. And no one's listening. That scares the hell out of me. No one's listening.
Well, that frightens me too. It does. I think people take a position and they don't let go sometimes, even when presented with evidence to the contrary.
What's been shocking to me related to all of this more than anything has been the medical and mental health colleagues in the field who I had an assumption were trained and valued learning as they work through their career. And I assumed that people in those fields, as field I'm in, would welcome being presented with new information and different viewpoints and would want to grapple with the evidence in an effort to provide the best care, to be the most responsible and ethical and evidence-based. And so I think what's been most shocking to me has been my colleagues in the very field that is doing the work, for whatever reason, resistant to doing that, to having the hard conversations, to really looking at their own biases and blind spots and wanting to grow and evolve with the field. I've reflected on my own experience over the last 15 years in this field, and I have evolved significantly as I've learned more and as more research has come out and as I've seen more patients and as the patient population has changed, I've had to pivot. And when I see colleagues not pivoting, it concerns me greatly because I really don't know of any other area of medicine where people don't do that. It seems like a rare thing for people to not evolve in their professional understanding of whatever the area is they're working, particularly in medicine.
You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Sandra Keg. We are going to take our second commercial break. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Start your day the right way with Revive Active's range of super supplements and get the most out of life. Take one power-packed sachet mixed with water and enjoy a super tasty health drink at work, at home or on the go. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to optimize your health and well-being to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health and more. No filler, no stimulants, no artificial colors or preservatives. Just the right mix of vitamins, minerals, amino acids, and hero ingredients to help you put back what life takes out. Try our 7-day or 30-day boxes and use code UKRADIO to get a free supplement shaker. Revive Active. Super supplements for a super you.
Nature's Medicine for Modern Living, a people and plants dialogue hosted by Sophie.Health. At Sophie, we bring together experts and voices who rarely cross paths. Our quest is to illuminate the ancient world of plant medicine and reimagine it for the connected age. Join us to explore new boundaries of digital personalized medicine with deep roots in the natural world. And hear from our community of international pioneers who are validating this new paradigm and improving how we feel, sleep, and cope with daily stresses naturally. Sophie.Health, reconnecting people and plants.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Kagg. Our guests this hour are Drs. Erica Anderson, Jameson Green, Laura Edwards-Leeper. We hope that you are enjoying our panelists' conversation centered on transgender care. Let's get back to where we left off.
I couldn't agree more, and that's been my experience too, Laura, as you know. I just can't tell you how much it rankles me to hear this mantra repeated over and over again, the science is settled. Most scientists recognize that science evolves. And so to be defensive and resistant to learning anything is antithetical to being a scientist. Laura and I have had this experience the last couple of years of looking at what's going on in Europe with the health authorities there and the systematic evidence reviews. And we have now colleagues in Europe that we talk to all the time. And when we bring that up, clinical colleagues in the United States, they act like we're talking about something that they're not interested in. They don't really care. The level of ethnocentrism and American exceptionalism that I've encountered in this field, it exceeds every other area in which I've delved. Oh, no, we don't need to pay attention to Europe. And I'm thinking, wow, that is just a shock position to take.
My doctorate is in law. And that is a mantra in the legal field. We don't care what they do in Europe. Mm-hmm. This is American law. And I took my degree in the UK and studied international law and did comparative US and UK law. And I value comparison. I value diversity. I value introspection and inspection. And I value rational thought,
yes,
regardless of culture.
Yes. I'm worried on behalf of our future that a lot of young people haven't seemed to yet grasp the ability to do critical thinking. And
that's very true.
They get their information from a few sources and They don't compare. They don't examine. They don't question.
And that's right. And I think that's a serious problem.
It's a serious problem. And too many people have really deficient healthcare or health information literacy. Literally, I had an example earlier today. Parents told me that their trans feminine teenager said, oh, I don't need to get electrolysis because when I take estrogen, my facial hair will disappear, which is factually mistaken. It's not true. It's not true.
Yes.
And that's the kind of example I hear all the time of people who think something is true that is blatantly untrue.
We're going to be closing up here momentarily, but I wanted to just piggyback on something that you said, Laura, about ethics. As a licensed clinical social worker, I'm duty bound. I think one of the issues here is it's about evidence-based care. We are required to stay abreast of new evidence and apply it. And I think this is one of the areas where there's contention. What is evidence? Is physician consensus, is that evidence? Is patient report, is that evidence? Or is it only a randomized clinical trial? But we know medically speaking, there's a hierarchy of what's considered evidence. And this is where I think we can have some more discussion. And what's great about that is we are going to have a second episode. So Dr. Anderson and Dr. Green and Dr. Edwards-Leeper will return. So we can talk about what is meant by evidence-based. And we can also talk about another critical topic, which in our fields, which is informed consent. And that crosses over the medical and the legal. And I know Dr. Ahn has just recently published a paper in a journal about informed consent. So I think we'll have a really wonderful conversation when we meet again next week. Thank you, everybody, for being here on the panel today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Xander. Thank you, Dr. Ahn.
Thank you, everyone. We have come to the end of the Umbrella Hour. We hope that you have been enjoying the discussion among the panel of experts. Please join us next time, and thank you for listening.